Well, welcome to this next session on the class on Ecclesiastes, Searching for the Meaning of Life. We're going to pick up in chapter 8. We left off at the end of chapter 7 last session, where Solomon admitted, you could say he confessed, that he understands the world's crookedness is not a fault of the way God has ordered the world. He says that God created humankind upright, or as the Hebrew means, straight, and that each person has gone off and pursued many schemes. And those schemes are what has made the world crooked. And it seems that Solomon's own pursuit of the meaning of life through his observational, or you could say his empirical or experiential framework, methodology, but that is his own attempt at trying to understand the meaning of life, his own scheme, you might say, that has not resulted in or yielded any real results. And wisdom was what he was preoccupied with. And he's going to carry on the idea of wisdom here in chapter 8 again. He's going to relate the idea of wisdom and how that then plays out with authority and people who are in positions of power. And again, he's going to bring up the issue of injustice. Let's get into chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 1, if you have your Bible, turn there. And verse 1, it says, "Who is like the wise man? And who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed." Who is like the wise man, and who knows the interpretation of a thing? Well, likely these questions are rhetorical in nature, and Solomon probably intends them to be answered in the negative, that nobody knows what a real wise man is like, and no one really truly knows the interpretation of a thing. He's referring really to the interpretation of life here. Who knows the actual real answer? So likely he's saying really nobody, but he goes on to talk about wisdom in a scenario using a person who stands before a king. But before he gets there, he talks about the way that wisdom can affect a person's demeanor. He says, man's wisdom makes his face shine and the hardness of his face is changed. That with wisdom, a person can know how to behave or present themselves before someone else, and that their face can change because they have wisdom, and the hardness of their face or maybe their scowl or a frown can turn into a smile because they know when they're approaching someone that the way they present themselves and their appearance and their facial expression affects the way the person receives them. So let's move into the scenario of standing before the king. Verse 2 says, "I say, keep the king's command." So that's how we know that the scenario involves being in front of royalty, the king's command. So keep the king's command because of the oath of God. Now this might refer to the oath that one takes before God, or could be the oath of God to uphold the king's throne, which is a common understanding in the ancient Israelite culture, was that the throne of the king is something that was established by God. And we know from the Old Testament, there are references to where God does put people on the throne in Israel, and even makes promises to people like David, that one of his descendants will always sit on the throne. That ultimately gets fulfilled in his long descendant, Jesus, as a son of David. But here, he's mainly about the idea of, like, if you're standing before a king and the king tells you something to do, Solomon is saying, you should do it. You should keep the command because of the oath of God. Verse 3, "Do not be hasty to go out from his presence. Do not persist in an evil thing, for he does whatever pleases him. For the king's word is authoritative. Who can say to him, what are you doing?" The scenario further unfolds here, and the instruction that Solomon gives is to not run out of the king's presence. Now, the Hebrew can also be restructured that you should leave the king's presence, because otherwise he's basically saying two different things. He's saying, don't leave. And then he's saying, don't persist in an evil thing by remaining. So he's almost saying two contradictory statements then. So it might be better to understand the hastiness to go with the oath of God in the previous verse, and that when you are given a command by God, you should go out from the king's presence and carry out the command. And that would make better sense than of do not persist in evil thing. Now, the evil thing is not evil in like a moral category. It's more probably along the lines of a bad idea that you continue to argue with the king for your bad idea. Could also just be that any opposition to the king is seen as evil because he has full authority, is total authority. So when you're given a command for you to then sort of oppose the idea or refuse, that's rebellion. You're rebelling against the authority of the king. But it's probably more just about trouble. You know, don't persist in causing trouble, or don't persist in opposing the king, for the king does whatever he pleases. Now, the scenario here of the ruler is a monarchical government, you know, of like ancient Israel, where the king held complete power. It was a totalitarian government. So whatever the king said, that was law. That was what you did. For who can say to him, what are you doing? I don't think the king probably heard this a whole lot, I'm presuming, because when you hold all the power, people are not really able to then question what you're doing. But this idea of monarchical government, this was the common form of government in the ancient world. Nothing out of the ordinary here. The king in Israel held all the power, and God was the one who established the king in Israel. So it's not like this totalitarian government is somehow not sanctioned by God. This was set up by God. So the scenario Solomon is pointing to is not some sort of abuse of power. This is just the way to understand power dynamics. And when somebody is superior to you and holds power, there is a certain way in which you are to interact with that person. But sometimes I think wisdom is about knowing when to keep your mouth shut. It's knowing when to talk and when not to talk. And it depends on who you're with, who you're standing in front of, to know whether or not you should say something or shouldn't say something. Now, take for example, if you're driving again, we're going to use driving as another analogy, illustration. You're driving your car, and all of a sudden you look in the rearview mirror and you see these red and blue lights flashing behind you. You know that you got to pull over. That's the police. Now, the police, they tell you, please get out of your car and put your hands in the air. If you do anything besides what the police officer is telling you, you're persisting in an evil thing. You're causing trouble for yourself. You're going to suffer by not acquiescing to the command. You're told, get out of the car, put your hands in the air. The police officer has the authority. They are your superior in this regard. They have the power, and you're supposed to then follow their instruction, or you could say command. But if you don't, it's going to spell bad news for you. This is like what Solomon is trying to say with the king, that the king has the authority. And if you refuse him, or if you continue to argue with him, if you question him, dude, what are you doing? It's just going to be bad for you. You're going to suffer, and it is unwise. Verse 5, whoever keeps the commandment, now this is presumably what the king says, keeping the king's commandment, what the king tells you to do, will not come to harm. So if you do what the king says, you're not going to get in trouble. You're not going to suffer. You don't, well, you have a bad thing coming. And here, his wise heart, so the person standing before the king, his wise heart will know the proper time and procedure. For there is a proper time and procedure for every purpose. It may not be as readily obvious, perhaps, in the English, but in the Hebrew, this is very closely worded with what we read in chapter 3. For example, in chapter 3, verse 1, it says, for everything there is a season and a time, or a proper time, for every matter under heaven. The word here, purpose, is the same word for matter, the same word for time. I think Solomon is here, he's drawing on that idea of that there is a time in which something should be done, and there's a time in which it should not. And here, the person who is wise, that has a wise heart, they're wise in their heart, they will recognize and they will know when that time is. Now, here at the end of this verse 6, he says that there is a time for everything, a time and a procedure for every purpose, even though the misery of man is heavy on him. Likely, this misery of man is, I think, just referring to kind of like the normal life trouble and distress that happens to a person. That throughout the course of life, there's a lot of things that weigh heavy on humankind. Lots of life troubles and lots of stressors, things that put you into distress. And so there is a time and a place to understand, even though everybody is dealing with the same burdens that life brings. Now, one of those burdens is spelled out in verse 7. For no one knows what will happen, because who can tell him when it will happen? One of the things that humans deal with is their finite scope of knowledge. We do not know the future, and no one can tell us the future and when things are going to happen. We are in the dark as to whatever is going to transpire this moment forward. So part of that then is not knowing really how to act, because in previous sessions, one of the things that Solomon talked about is it's difficult to know what to do when you don't know how it will turn out. You don't know the future because you need to know how things will end up in order to know if the action was correct or accurate for that moment. And Solomon's saying, a burden of us humans is we don't know that. It is unknowable. And therefore, we really can't be able to have the certainty of knowing what's right and how to act in a certain situation. In verse 8, Solomon's going to use four examples of things that exemplify powerlessness. So he just talked about in verse 7 about the powerlessness to know the future and this being part of the burden and heavy weight and misery that humans have to deal with in life. Now he gives four additional instances of powerlessness. It says, there is no man who has power over the spirit to retain the spirit, and no one has power over the day of his death. No one is discharged in that war, and wickedness will not rescue its owners. These are the four. The thing here about the power over the spirit to retain the spirit and the power, no one has power over the day of his death, is referring to the inability of people to actually change their destiny. That when people go to the grave, nobody can then somehow resurrect themselves back to life. They can't retain their spirit so that it does not depart from the body, which is what Solomon talks about. We don't know, he says, the future and after death, what happens to a person, whether their spirit goes up or their spirit goes down, he says. We don't know, because he's thinking about everything from an observational data point. He can't see what happens after somebody dies and thereby know that answer. So no one has the power to then retain their spirit. No one has power over the day of his death. No one can change the what happens if when they die, that if that's the day that you expire, people then can't just say, well, I want to switch it to next month after that, if you would please. Nobody can do that. We're powerless to that. Now, the next two are a little more tricky to understand. What is Solomon really getting at? No one's discharged in that war. Now, he might be referring to the type of warfare that Israel was involved in commonly, that if you were enlisted to go to war, that you didn't have a choice on if you were discharged from that war. If you were to go to war, then you were to go to war. It was out of your control. And likely, the second part, wickedness will not rescue its owners. This also is a little complicated as to what wickedness he's referring to and how it is supposed to rescue the person who owns it. Now, it's just a way of saying the person who commits wickedness. That wickedness doesn't do anything to help a person, and that there's no power that a person has to make it do what they want to do. It could also be that Solomon has in mind here the scheming of humans. Human scheming doesn't actually accomplish what people really think it does. And maybe the the local status, people are, they think they get their way. But in the long run of life and in the ultimate answer and judgment of what happens in with God's justice, it doesn't actually rescue and provide with what a person thinks it does. So verse 9, Solomon has seen all this. All this I have seen and applied my heart. So this is his, he's giving everything he has, his whole heart. He's investing himself completely to look and understand every work that is done under the sun. And there is a time, he says, when one man has power over another to his hurt. His conclusion is that powerlessness just seems to be part of the way the world is. He sees that there are these circumstances in which people are powerless, and there's a time in which somebody has power and they exert it over somebody else to their harm, and that person is powerless to defend against it. He's making, I think, just an observational claim here about the world, that powerlessness and oppression just are part of what he sees happening all around him. Verse 10, indeed, he goes on to talk more about wickedness here. I saw the wicked, so the people who commit this wickedness, he sees them buried and departed. So he's essentially saying they've lived their life and I watched them. They died and they were buried. And he reminisces then on these people. They used to come in and go out from the holy place. So it seems that these people were somehow involved in the ritual worship of Yahweh in the temple, and they were praised in the city where they did their wickedness, where they did such things. This also is pointless. Why is it pointless? Why did he saying he sees these wicked people, they die and they're buried. And these people used to come and go in the temple, and they were, you know, exalted and lauded for their wickedness in the city. But this is pointless. Well, why is, what's pointless about it? Because in verse 11, the sentence, meaning the judgment of the judge, the court's judgment against that wickedness, the sentence against them from an evil act, is not executed speedily. These people lived and died, and they didn't get punished, he's saying. They didn't have the sentence against their wickedness carried out. And therefore, so since they didn't, the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Wow. I think this is a really interesting observation that Solomon is coming to here. To watch wicked people live their life and maybe live long lives as what he saw, what he expressed seeing earlier, and then dying and getting buried and never actually receiving the judgment and the sentence to punish them for their wickedness. That therefore, the hearts of people are set on doing evil. I think he's saying, monkey see, monkey do. He says, when people see wicked people doing wicked things and not getting in trouble for it, it then entices other people to do those wicked things. There are countless stories of criminals who've committed crimes because they saw someone else doing it and they thought they could get away with it too. Now, it may not be a criminal act, but this past Sunday at church, I was near our pantry in the church where we store our snacks, and there was a kid that came out of the pantry with a bag of chips in his hand. And then I asked if he was allowed to have those, and if his parents said it was okay. Obviously, he was like, mm-hmm. And then he ran out. Well, guess what happened a minute later? Two more kids came running into the pantry, and they wanted a bag of chips too, because they saw the other kid got them. And I asked them, did your mom and dad say it was okay to have a bag of chips? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if that's true or not. I probably got lied to. But it's that the whole principle is that when people see the other people do something and not get punished for it, there's a sense in which they're like, well, maybe I can too. Maybe I can also do that and get away with it. And so one of the things Solomon is saying here that is perplexing to him, it's pointless because he's like, I don't get why God is not judging these people and punishing them here and now. Because since they're not getting punished, because this injustice is going on, other people are becoming more bold to do evil. He doesn't understand it. In verse 12 here, he continues on with this, the issue of wickedness. He says, though a sinner does evil 100 times and lives long. Here again, there's this injustice of the wicked getting to live a long life where they shouldn't. But if a sinner does a wickedness or evil 100 times, he's basically just conflating the whole thing. Let's say their whole life was evil and it was long and prosperous. He says, yet, surely I know that it will be better for those who fear God, who are reverent before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, nor will he lengthen his days like a shadow, because he does not fear God. This, I think, is the first assertion that Solomon makes that departs from his methodology of observation. It's really outside the scope of his inquiry to know if it really will be better for those who fear God. Because in his framework of inquiry, you can't know what's going to be better or worse after you die. And so when he sees everything happening and mixed up on the earth, he's like, who knows what's going to happen after you die? Who knows whether or not wisdom is better or wickedness is better? You can't make that judgment because what's happening right now doesn't sort it out. However, he's now breaking his methodology. And this is critical. This is a critical telltale of Ecclesiastes here, where he's admitting his methodology doesn't answer the question, but he has knowledge outside of that methodology. He knows something not taught to him by observing the world, by rational inquiry. He says he knows that it will be better. There will be something better for those who fear God than for the wicked. And what is that? Why, he's alluding here to an ultimate judgment, which isn't part of his methodology, isn't the way that he is searching for the answer on the meaning of life. But he has other knowledge about what is true regarding reality. And he here brings that forward. He talks about that even if somebody looks to be prosperous in this life through evil and wicked acts, that they will not ultimately prosper. That justice is coming, even if it's not observable right now, that there will be justice for that person. And because of that, or I should say there'll be judgment, you know, justice will be carried out. Because of that, then the person who is not under that judgment will fare better. There's a distinction between when Solomon says, what I saw under heaven versus what he says, I know. This is a distinction that's vastly different in the way that he's processing information. And we begin to see the dilemma that he's facing. What we've covered the whole time has been him looking around and trying to understand what is the actual answer to all this work and the life that people are living under the sun. He's now coming to this crisis where he's like, I don't see the difference, but I know there is one. I know that it matters. There is one other time where Solomon did express something to this effect. And this was back in chapter 3. He says in verse 16 and 17, moreover, I saw this under the sun. So he says he saw this, the place where that there's supposed to be justice, there was wickedness, and the place of righteousness, you know, the place where there was righteousness, that wickedness was there. In the verse 17, I said in my heart, it doesn't say I know, but it's another expression of that he has internal understanding or internal knowledge. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous person and the wicked person, for there is a time of judgment for every purpose and for every deed. So while Solomon is trying to carry out by wisdom, you know, rational inquiry, this quest to understand the meaning of life, he knows there's more to life. He knows something is beyond what he can see in the world. The judgment of God wasn't something that Solomon observed or could watch in action. It was a complete absence for him of what he saw under the sun. Judgment and justice were not happening. where there was supposed to be justice, there was wickedness, and where there was supposed to be righteousness, that wickedness was there. It was flip-flopped. He brings up this sort of like irony, I guess you'd say, the pointlessness he sees with how life is not transpiring the way he thinks it should. This is the pointlessness that he brings up again here in verse 14. There is a pointless thing that is done on the earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked, meaning there are righteous people who then receive, you could say, the outcome, the effect, the punishment that wicked people should get. And there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous, meaning that they get rewarded for their wickedness. They prosper. They're successful. They live long lives. There's an inverse relationship happening here that he sees. And this is pointless, he says. He's saying that the looking at the world and how it operates in this way, it does not answer a single thing for him. But he does have knowledge. Nevertheless, what he does, he comes to this kind of like end conclusion. So given all this sort of pointlessness and what he knows to be true, but he doesn't yet see it happening, his recommendation. So I recommend, he says, the enjoyment of life. I recommend the enjoyment of life because a man has no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink and to be merry. And that will accompany him in his labor all the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. This is almost like a least common denominator, baseline, sort of like in the least, this is what you can do. And I think sometimes that's the way we operate. Sometimes when we're not sure what the right thing to do is, well, we sometimes just kind of like deviate and go to what's second best. You know, we just do what we don't. In the least, this can be done. For example, like if you have a credit card bill coming up and you're not sure if your bank account is going to have the money in it from your paycheck and you don't want your payment to bounce or be overdrawn, depending on what era you come from, well, you can at least make the minimum balance payment, right? In the least, you can make that payment. It's usually not that much. It's a very nominal figure. Or if you're trying to figure out what to wear and you're getting ready to go to a party and you're not sure what everybody else is going to dress like or if you should, you know, wear this or that, well, you can wear a modest outfit in a neutral color. It's like, in the least, you could do that. That's not a bad way to go if you're not sure. So here, when Solomon still hasn't worked out his answer yet, he's unsure. He says, at least I recommend enjoying life. That if you see oppression, if you see injustice, and if you see power dynamics out of whack and you don't understand, if it's all an enigma and mysterious and kind of super complex, just enjoy life. Enjoy the work that God has given you to do. Eat, drink, be merry, and this is the fruit of your labor. Enjoy that all the days that God has given you under the sun. I think that's pretty good advice, despite not really knowing the big answers to the question of life. So at least he's kind of like at that position now. And this is not the only time he's said this. This is at least the third time Solomon has reiterated that on his quest, he doesn't have the answer, but at least he says, you should enjoy life. You should eat and drink and be merry. This is like bottom line, base level. This is a good thing to do with the life God has given us. Let's close here in verses 16 and 17, the end of chapter 8. Solomon says, when I applied my heart, again, this is a reference to his whole self. I applied my heart to know wisdom. That's his search. He's looking to have wisdom into the meaning of life, to see the activity that is done on the earth. Indeed, there is one that neither day nor night sees sleep with his eyes. And I think this is a reflexive reference to himself because of all the effort he's putting forth, basically producing kind of insomnia. His mind is preoccupied all day and all night, and it prevents him from having any rest. He claims to have saw all the work of God. And his conclusion is that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun, meaning cannot find out the meaning of all of it. Because however much man labors to seek it out, however much effort a person gives to seek it out, yet he will not find it. He will not find it. And even if a wise man thinks he can, The wise man thinks he can discover it or comprehend it. Solomon says he won't be able to. He will not be able to find it. This is a little bit of a pessimistic conclusion to his section, but I want to frame it in the way that this actually is a step forward for Solomon. In his quest and inquiry to try to understand the meaning of life, he's been searching and searching, thinking he can get the answer, that by adding one thing onto another, by his wisdom of rational thought, he could figure it out. And here he's professing that it is not possible, that I applied my heart, I did everything, I saw all the work that was happening, and no matter how much a person seeks to get that wisdom or the answer, the meaning of life, you won't be able to find it. And even if a wise person thinks they can find it, which Solomon wants to be wise and thinks himself wise, but even if it was a truly wise person, he says, they would fail too. There are some things that maybe we just really don't need to have the answer to in life. I'm very comfortable with certain questions just being completely ignorant about, such as, I don't know how big the universe is, and I don't really think it matters knowing the answer to that question. I bet you I would not be surprised if 1,000 years from now, if we are no closer to knowing that answer, wouldn't be surprised in the least. There are some answers I think that are really unknowable, but there are some questions that need an answer, such as, why are we here? Not how did we get here? That's evading the real issue. We must come to know, what is the purpose for my existence? What is the ultimate meaning for why I'm here? That's a question I think that we must seek an answer for. And I believe there is one, and Solomon has not yet presented us with his answer to that question. However, Solomon has come to realize that all the effort in the world will not yield the answer to what one is looking for under the sun. Observational data will not reveal the secret to the meaning of life. And so Solomon here is despairing that all this work that's done under the sun, no matter how much one tries to figure it out, it's a lost cause. This is Solomon's first step in admitting the fault in his methodology, and that how he's been going around trying to figure out the answer has all been in vain. But the story is not over yet. A great reminder for keeping the truth of God's plan and purposes in perspective is that we don't know all the details of how God is going to bring about justice in this world, or how everything actually really works. It's his plan, and he's working out it according to his purposes in his own time. And while the frustration when we see the wicked succeeding or prospering, that may plague our lives in the present age, and we, like Solomon, we know that it will be better for those who fear Yahweh and live righteously. The author of Hebrews said this in chapter 6, verse 10, "For God is not unrighteous as to forget your work and the love that you showed toward his name by having ministered to the holy ones and in your continuing to minister." We can trust that God is going to see to it that the righteous are rewarded and the wicked are punished. And the answer to why we are here is yet on the horizon, as Solomon will lead us down yet a couple more chapters to his final conclusion. We'll see you next time.